Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by Lynn Harlow, an artist and art instructor who recently finished teaching a course that was part of New York's Museum of Modern Art's online learning program, a course entitled Experimenting with Collage. Whenever conversation turns to what online learning cannot possibly cover, studio art runs neck and neck with laboratory science as a skill that requires hands-on activities involving tools, be those paintbrushes or beakers, and interactions between substances and humans existing in genuine versus virtual reality. But with regard to experimental science, someone clearly didn't get the word out to David Cox, the professor behind the upcoming Harvard X neuroscience class regular listeners heard a few weeks back, that the physical lab experiments he has incorporated into his MOOC cannot be done. And as I face out over 10 weeks of experiments I'll be running in my kitchen as part of my just-started food and science class, or possibly my mom's kitchen since we're taking the course together, it seems as though things we consider to be intrinsically impossible for online learning may simply reflect things that have not yet been tried. Now, teaching art, particularly studio art, involves feedback loops between students creating something and fellow students and teachers who can analyze and critique that work. So the fact that some subjects like collage have been taught successfully online doesn't necessarily mean they can be taught at the kind of scale we've seen in many a MOOC class. But before deciding what can and cannot work in an online learning environment, let's find out what's already been accomplished by talking to the teacher who has accomplished it. Lynn Harlow, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Thanks, John.
Before we start talking about the online collage course you taught, can you tell listeners a little bit about your work as an artist?
Sure. I have an independent practice as an artist. I have a studio that I maintain, and I exhibit my work on a pretty regular basis. And the work that I make is a combination of smaller-scale drawings and prints, things that tend to go on the wall, and large-scale installation work, a lot of temporary sculpture that is exhibited in specific locations. My work is very reductive, and it tends to be a lot about color and geometry.
And you've got a couple shows coming up, is that right?
I do. I have a couple of pieces that will be in the DeCordova Biennial at the DeCordova Sculpture Park and Art Museum in Lincoln, Massachusetts. And that show begins in October. It's happening right now. And I'm also preparing for a solo project at Minaspace, a very interesting gallery in Brooklyn that is devoted to reductive art.
Can you talk about Minaspace a little bit?
Minaspace began as an online project. It began as a website gallery showing work by artists all over the world that were somehow working in a language of reduction. So coming out of the idea of 60s minimalism, but going beyond that and looking at what it means to work in this language today. So the work shares that common emphasis, but even so, the work is amazingly varied. And what the directors found, the space is run by Matthew Delegate and Rosanna Martinez, they found that there was an enormous interest in New York and internationally. So they decided that they wanted to move this beyond a web project, and they actually opened a physical gallery space several years ago. And it continues to grow and be more and more trafficked and noted, and they're enjoying a lot of enthusiasm right now from critics and other artists. It's a really exciting time for Minaspace.
Switching over to your teaching career, can you tell us how you ended up teaching an online course for MoMA?
Well, I had taught some on-site classes for MoMA a number of years ago, so that was really how I began to get involved with education programs at the museum. And MoMA has been through a really interesting evolution in terms of what it's teaching. Probably 40 or 50 years ago, MoMA offered art making classes at the museum. And then that fell out of favor, and they really were only teaching art history for quite a long time. Then in about 2006, Amy Horshack in the education department thought that it would actually be a really interesting thing to reintroduce art making at the museum. And so she recruited a number of educators, including me, to teach things like drawing and printmaking. And I taught printmaking there a number of times. And then Amy's next step was to think about offering online classes as well as what she was offering on site. And she decided to offer not only the art history classes, but to attempt some art making classes as well. And that was a really new thing to take on. There aren't many places, even now, that are offering art making. So Amy was really doing something pretty innovative, and she developed a terrific format for it. And she invited me to teach the online collage class, which is what I did in the spring.
Listeners will be extremely interested about how a art making class that involves doing studio art online works. So can you talk a little bit about what the curriculum was, what you asked students to do, how they interacted online?
The collage class was designed with several components so that students coming into the class really had a lot of different types of information to work from. So there are video segments that include demonstrations of different kinds of techniques, how to glue certain materials together, how to produce certain kinds of layering effects, things like that. But in addition, because it's being offered by MoMA and they have such an extraordinary collection, there's also a lot of collections of collage images from MoMA's holdings that become part of the course. And they act as really interesting examples of very different approaches to collage. And furthermore, they have such terrific educators and lecturers who are affiliated with the department. They shot a video of educators in the galleries looking at particular works and talking about what makes them really key examples of collage technique. So we were combining all of those things as a way to guide students and say, these are the tools you can use, and these are the historic examples that can guide you as you think about making something completely new.
And students are also making their own work and sharing it. Can you talk about what that process was like?
Well, each week there was a specific type of collage or time period that we looked at, and then an assignment was given. So each week the students had something specific to go on. You know, it wasn't just a collage free-for-all. So I think that's important, mostly in terms of having the students all work within a certain set of parameters so that when they look at one another's work, it's not all over the place. Like, they can say, this is what I made in the style of a 50s pop collage, and this is what my classmates did in response to that same kind of work. So there was a coherence. But even so, the student work that was generated varied enormously, but the materials that they were working with tended to stay somewhat consistent, since the video demonstration that they had all watched really emphasized certain kinds of materials. Like, one week people would be encouraged to work with different kinds of papers. Another week people might be encouraged to include objects and things like that on their surfaces.
And how do students share their work, and what kind of critiquing and discussion took place regarding work submitted for class?
Students were asked to take digital photos of the work that they made and post them as frequently as they wanted. So a number of the students would photograph and post the works while they were in progress, which was very interesting. And then, of course, a completed project as well. And the platform that we used for the MoMA course allowed students to constantly comment on one another's work and be in dialogue with each other about what they were making, and also maybe challenges that they were facing as they moved along in the projects. So students got feedback all the time from one another, and I would also comment in a more casual way throughout the week as people were making their pieces. But then once the project was finished, I would give each of them a more formal critique with a more in-depth response to what they had made, suggestions for what they might think about going forward. So like a classroom art setting, it was a combination of peer feedback and instructor response.
And any highlights you could share in terms of breakthroughs or other positive experiences students had in the class?
Well, I think that, again, like a classroom experience, what I found happening in a number of situations was that assignments that people initially disliked and found maybe a little too challenging were the ones that ultimately became the most interesting and satisfying for them. So at the beginning of the week, somebody's saying, oh, I don't like this week's assignment. I can't get my head around it. And a few days later, they're posting something that's really exciting. And to see that shift just in a matter of days is always really gratifying. And especially, I think, since the students weren't benefiting from the kind of collective energy that you generate in a classroom, that they were still managing to get that from this online relationship that they had with their other students.
And what were some of the biggest challenges managing online projects that involve the creation of physical visual artifacts in the real world? Did the digital photos cut it?
The photos were great, but it's never the same as seeing the actual object. And this goes back to the ongoing conversation that we've been having for as long as photography's been around in terms of art. Can you look at a reproduction and have the same response? So something is lost, for sure, when you're photographing work, particularly something like collage that very often involves texture and surface variation. But despite that, there's so much that we were able to see and talk about in these digital images of people's work that although the photos are never going to give us all of the information about the surfaces and also the scale. Scale can be an issue because you lose that when it's a photo on your screen. Despite that, we really had enough really interesting information conveyed in these digital photos that there was plenty to talk about and plenty to learn from.
This class was about 30 people, was it?
Yes, that's right. It was about 30 people. And what I found was that probably a half to two-thirds of the participants really were involved in the day-to-day exchange, commenting on one another's work and making observations about the material. The remainder seemed more comfortable just doing the assignments and absorbing what was being said or typed essentially by their classmates without really engaging in the dialogue themselves.
It's an open question whether MOOCs struggle to build community because of their online nature, because of their massiveness. I mean, many of them are 1,000 times larger than the course you taught. Your class was the size of a traditional classroom, but students didn't share a physical space. How much do you think classes like MoMA's could scale up before you really have to completely change the way they work?
I think one of the things that is really valuable about the format that MoMA uses and the class size is that with that number of students, an instructor really can respond at length to a project each week and give a lot of meaningful feedback to each of the students. And that's part of the real value, I think, of that kind of course. When you go much beyond 30 students, I think that becomes really difficult. Then it becomes much more about a student just getting a little guidance, making some things at home, but not really having a meaningful exchange with an instructor. I think that's really what is so valuable about this particular format.
And if somebody was looking to create a class that involved interacting with physical objects at a significant scale, anything from your experience that might be able to inform them on how they might be able to approach it?
Well, I think it would be very important to be really, really specific about the materials involved. It seems that one of the benefits of a smaller group is that you can be a little bit fluid about what you're teaching and how you're teaching it. When it gets to be a really large scale thing, you don't have that luxury anymore. And so I think the only way to be speaking effectively about the actual physical making is to say, okay, everybody should use these three materials and take these three steps to keep some consistency and then allow people to make the work and have a conversation about the work where they're all confident that they're talking about and thinking about the same set of things.
Well, Lynn, I want to thank you for joining us and wish you luck with all your openings and upcoming work.
Oh, thanks very much. It's nice to talk to you.
That was Lynn Harlow, the teacher of MoMA's online course Experimenting with Collage. And having spent time looking at specific instances of online learning involving creating something physical, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the intersection of virtual and real-world learning spaces. When I first started this project, learning badges were all the rage. These involved systems that allowed instructors of online classes to award badges, basically digital graphics associated with metadata doled out to students through some form of controlled distribution, that were going to allow online classes to assign students activities in the real world which could be documented through the awarding of one or more badges. Enthusiasm over badging has cooled somewhat in recent months, once people realize that confirming a student has done the work to earn a badge is no different than confirming that they've completed any other type of assignment for an online course. And then you've got questions regarding calibration. Notably, if a student receives one badge for adding a comment to a discussion board, another one for writing a 50-page paper, how can we demonstrate the significant difference in value between these two badges, especially given the tendency to respect quantity, as in the number of badges earned, versus the quality or intrinsic superiority of one badge over another? Now, it just so happens that these same issues plague MOOCs in general. How do you know if students are cheating or cutting corners when they take an online quiz or write a peer-graded paper, for example? And why should a student who completes one MOOC that demands 20 or 30 hours of work per week for 3 months, and another student who takes a 6-week course where the grade is based on nothing more than passing an easy multiple-choice test, both be given credit for taking one course? And in justice similar to the fact that someone who reads War and Peace, another person who reads Hop on Pop, can both claim to have read one book. But all these issues aside, badging, like the experiments going on in Lynn's collage course for my science and cooking class, represent game attempts to break down this alleged third wall between learning off a screen and learning in a non-virtual environment. Those who read the Degree of Freedom blog know that I occasionally try to apply lessons learned from some recently completed class to the subject of MOOCs and online learning. And most recently, this involved looking at what modern philosophy, which is both inspired by and inspired modern science, had to say about how human beings come to understand anything about the real world. I'm not planning to go all philosophy dweeb on you, but a debate that's raged over the last 300 years has been between empiricists, who claim that everything we know comes from what we see, hear, smell, taste, and feel, i.e. sense perception, versus rationalists, who claim that the only thing we can know with certainty is what exists inside our own heads, as in I think, therefore I am. But the philosopher I just finished studying, Immanuel Kant, created a synthesis of these two schools of thought that still speaks to us today. For Kant saw that all our knowledge begins with sense perception, but is only our own previously existing mental faculties that turns this flood of sensory information into actual understanding. For instance, we perceive a dog running towards us in the form of hundreds or thousands of images of dogs of varying sizes. But our internal, unconscious understanding of how vision works allows us to know that these are all images of the same dog moving through space. I bring this up to point out that it's not just in online classes where you have to fill in gaps. By imagining the scale and tactile feel of a collage from a digital image, for instance, or figuring out how poking a worm with a probe turns into numeric data using resources already residing in our own minds, we're actually tapping these same resources when we interact with anything in the world. So rather than dwell on things that can't be done, perhaps we're better off sharpening our mind's eye and our ear and possibly nose, tongue, and fingers, and applying those tools to the components of online learning, which, after all, are just another set of sensory stimuli which requires our minds to turn into knowledge. And on that note, it's time to stop my own flood of sensory stimuli by calling it a show. But before signing off, a quick program note. As Degree of Freedom readers know, I've recently signed a contract to write a book on our favorite subject, MOOCs, for MIT Press. That's the good news. Unfortunately, for a book that both I and MIT want to appear next fall, the manuscript needs to be completed by the end of this year. I'm still planning to post regularly at the Degree of Freedom blog, and don't plan to drop any classes. But in order to clear a little room for a project I'm going to be treating as my senior thesis, this podcast, as well as the course reviews you've been reading in the Degree of Freedom newsletter, will be moving to a bi-weekly versus weekly schedule. So I hope you'll be able to join us in 2 weeks' time when I'll be back with the next Degree of Freedom podcast.